content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated June 23, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. And Time itself is in large block capital lettering in gray, superimposed upon a black background. This is apparently the orb pictured on the cover. It's like a sphere, but it's cut open in the front. And there's another sphere, which may be in its entirety inside. The outer layer is in a silver gray. The inside layer is in gold. And then there are some other circular apparatuses within the larger orb and enclosing the smaller orb. This is Are You Human? And I believe I'm going to be reading that to you momentarily. Indeed, technology is the heading. The orb, O-R-B, will see you now. An audacious startup wants to prove you are human. What else does it want? By Billy Perigo, San Francisco and Seoul. Photographs are by David Montalona for Time, and here's another photo of the orb as it was on the cover of the magazine, except this is in multicolors. The outer orb is a pale coppery tint, and there are inner orbs in blue, black, red, and green. Now to the text. Once again, Sam Altman wants to show you the future. The CEO of OpenAI, that's all one word, OpenAI, no spaces, is standing on a sparse stage in San Francisco, preparing to reveal his next move to an attentive crowd. We needed some way for identifying, authenticating humans in the age of AGI, Altman explains, referring to artificial general intelligence. We wanted a way to make sure humans stayed special and central. The solution Altman came up with is looming behind him. It is a white sphere about the size of a beach ball with a camera at its center. The company that makes it, known as Tools for Humanity, calls this mysterious device the orb. Stare into the heart of the plastic and silicon globe, and it will map the unique furrows and ciliary zones of your iris. Seconds later, you'll receive inviolable proof of your humanity, a 12,800-digit binary number known as an iris code sent to an app on your phone. At the same time, a packet of cryptocurrency called WorldCoin, worth approximately $42, will be transferred to your digital wallet, your reward for becoming a verified human. Altman co-founded Tools for Humanity in 2019 as part of a suite of companies he believed would reshape the world. Once the tech he was developing at OpenAI passed a certain level of intelligence, he reasoned, it would mark the end of one era on the Internet and the beginning of another, in which AI became so advanced, so human-like, that you would no longer be able to tell whether what you read, saw, or heard online came from a real person. When that happened, Altman imagined, we would need a new kind of online infrastructure, a human verification layer for the Internet, to distinguish real people from the proliferating number of bots and AI agents. And so, Tools for Humanity set out to build a global proof of humanity network. It aims to verify 50 million people by the end of 2025. Ultimately, its goal is to sign up every single human being on the planet. The free crypto serves as both an incentive for users to sign up and also an entry point into what the company hopes will become the world's largest financial network, through which it believes double-digit percentages of the global economy will eventually flow. Even for Altman, these missions are audacious. If this really works, it is like a fundamental piece of infrastructure for the world, Altman tells Time. In a video interview from the passenger seat of a car a few days before his April 30 keynote address. The project's goal is to solve a problem partly of Altman's own making. In the near future, he and other tech leaders say, advanced AIs will be imbued with agency, the ability to not just respond to human prompting, but also to take actions independently in the world. This will enable the creation of AI co-workers that can drop into your company and begin solving problems. AI tutors that can adapt their teaching style to students' preferences. Even AI doctors that can diagnose routine cases and handle scheduling or logistics. The arrival of these virtual agents, their venture capitalist backers predict, will turbocharge our productivity and unleash an age of material abundance. But AI agents will also have cascading consequences for the human experience online. As AI systems become harder to distinguish from people, websites may face difficult trade-offs, says a recent paper by researchers from 25 different universities, nonprofits, and tech companies, including OpenAI. There is a significant risk that digital institutions will be unprepared for a time when AI-powered agents, including those leveraged by malicious actors, overwhelm other activity online. On social media platforms like X and Facebook, bot-driven accounts are amassing billions of views on AI-generated content. In April, the foundation that runs Wikipedia disclosed AI bots scraping the site were making the encyclopedia too costly to sustainably run. Later the same month, researchers from the University of Zurich found AI-generated comments on the subreddit r/changemyview were up to 6 times as successful as human-written ones at persuading unknowing users to change their minds. The arrival of agents will not only threaten our ability to distinguish between authentic and AI content online, it will also challenge the Internet's core business model, online advertising, which relies on the assumption that ads are being viewed by humans. The Internet will change very drastically sometime in the next 12 to 24 months, says Tools for Humanity CEO Alex Blania. So we have to succeed, or I'm not sure what else would happen. For 4 years, Bolania's team has been testing the orb's hardware abroad. Now the U.S. rollout has arrived. Over the next 12 months, 7,500 orbs will be arriving in dozens of American cities in locations like gas stations, bodegas, flagship stores in Los Angeles, Austin, and Miami. The project's founders and fans hope the orb's U.S. debut will kickstart a new phase of growth. The San Francisco keynote was titled At Last. It is not clear the public appetite matches the exultant branding. Tools for Humanity has verified just 12 million humans since mid-2023, a pace Bolania concedes is well behind schedule. Few online platforms currently support the so-called world ID that the orb bestows upon its visitors, leaving little to entice users to give up their biometrics beyond the lure of free crypto. Even Altman is not sure whether the whole thing can work. I can see how this becomes a fairly mainstream thing in a few years, he says, or I can see that it is still only used by a small subset of people who think about the world in a certain way. Yet, as the internet becomes overrun with AI, the creators of this strange new piece of hardware are betting everybody in the world will soon want or need to visit an orb. The biometric code it creates, they predict, will become a new type of digital passport, without which you might be denied passage to the internet of the future, from dating apps to government services. In a best-case scenario, World ID could be a privacy-preserving way to fortify the internet against an AI-driven deluge of fake or deceptive content. It could also enable the distribution of universal basic income, UBI, a policy that Altman has previously touted as AI automation transforms the global economy. To examine what this new technology might mean, I reported from three continents, interviewed 10 Tools for Humanity executives and investors, reviewed hundreds of pages of company documents, and verified my own humanity. The internet will inevitably need some kind of proof of humanity system in the near future, says Divya Siddhart, founder of the nonprofit Collective Intelligence Project. The real question, she argues, is whether such a system will be centralized, a big security nightmare that enables a lot of surveillance, or privacy-preserving, as the orb claims to be. Questions remain about Tools for Humanity's corporate structure, its yoking to an unstable cryptocurrency, and what power it would concentrate in the hands of its owners, if successful. Yet it's only, also, one of the only attempts to solve what many see as an increasingly urgent problem. There are some issues with it, Siddhart says of the World ID, but you cannot preserve the internet in amber. Something in this direction is necessary. In March, I met Bolania at Tools for Humanity's San Francisco headquarters, where a large screen displays the number of weekly orb verifications by country. A few days earlier, the CEO had attended a $1 million per head dinner at Mar-a-Lago with President Donald Trump, whom he credits with clearing the way for the company's U.S. launch by relaxing crypto regulations. Given Sam is a very high-profile target, Bolania says, we just decided we would let other companies fight that fight and enter the U.S. once the air is clear. As a kid growing up in Germany, Bolania was a little different from his peers, other kids were like drinking a lot or doing a lot of parties, and I was just building a lot of things that could potentially blow up, he recalls. At the California Institute of Technology, where he was pursuing research for a master's degree, he spent many evenings reading the blogs of startup gurus like Paul Graham and Altman. Then in 2019, Blania received an email from Max Norvenstern, an entrepreneur who'd been kicking around a concept with Altman to build a global cryptocurrency network. They were looking for technical minds to help with the project. Over cappuccinos, Altman told Blania he was certain about three things. First, smarter than human AI was not only possible but inevitable, and it would soon mean you could no longer assume anything you read, saw, or heard on the internet was human created. Second, cryptocurrency and other decentralized technologies would be a massive force for change in the world. And third, scale was essential to any crypto network's value. The goal of WorldCoin, as the project was initially called, was to combine those three insights. Altman took a lesson from PayPal, the company co-founded by his mentor, Peter Thiel. Of its initial funding, PayPal spent less than $10 million actually building its app, but pumped an additional $70 million or so into a referral program, whereby new users and the person who invited them would each receive $10 in credit. The referral program helped make PayPal a leading payment platform. Altman thought a version of that strategy would propel WorldCoin to similar heights. He wanted to create a new cryptocurrency and give it to users as a reward for signing up. The more people who join the system, the higher the token's value would theoretically rise. Since 2019, the project has raised $244 million from investors like Coinbase and the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. That money paid for the $50 million cost of designing the orb, plus maintaining the software it runs on. The total market value of all WorldCoins in existence, however, is far higher, around $12 billion. That number is a bit misleading. Most of those coins are not in circulation, and WorldCoin's price has fluctuated wildly. Still, it allows the company to reward users for signing up at no cost to itself. The main lure for investors is the crypto upside. Some 75% of all world coins are set aside for humans to claim when they sign up, or as referral bonuses. The remaining 25% are split between tools for humanity's backers and staff, including Blania and Altman. I'm really excited to make a lot of money, Blania says. On a balmy afternoon this spring, I climb a flight of stairs up to a room above a restaurant in an outer suburb of Seoul. Five elderly South Koreans tap on their phones as they wait to be verified by the two orbs in the center of the room. We don't really know how to distinguish between AI and humans anymore, an attendant in a company t-shirt explains in Korean, gesturing toward the spheres. We need a way to verify that we are humans and not AI, so how do we do that? Well, humans have irises, but AI does not. The attendant ushers an elderly woman over to the orb. It bleeps. Open your eyes, a disembodied voice says in English. The woman stares into the camera. Seconds later, she checks her phone and sees that a packet of WorldCoin worth 75,000 Korean won, about $54, has landed in her digital wallet. Congratulations, the app tells her. You are now a verified human. A couple dozen orbs have been available in South Korea since 2023, verifying roughly 55,000 people. Now Tools for Humanity is redoubling its efforts there. At an event in a traditional wooden hanok house in central Seoul, an executive announces 250 orbs will soon be dispersed around the country, with the aim of verifying 1 million Koreans in the next 12 months. South Korea has high levels of smartphone usage, crypto and AI adoption, and internet access. While average wages are modest enough for the free WorldCoin on offer to still be an enticing draw, all of which makes it fertile testing ground for the company's ambitious global expansion. Yet things seem off to a slow start. In a retail space I visited in central Seoul, Tools for Humanity had constructed a wooden structure with 8 orbs facing one another. Locals and tourists wander past looking up amused. Few volunteer themselves up. Most who do tell me they are crypto enthusiasts who came intentionally, driven more by the spirit of early adoption than the free coins. The next day I visit a coffee shop in central Seoul where a chrome orb sits unassumingly in one corner. Wu Ruijun, a 20-year-old student from China, strikes up a conversation with the barista who doubles as the orb's operator. Wu was invited here by a friend who said both could claim free cryptocurrency if he signed up. The barista speeds him through the process. Wu accepts the privacy disclosure without reading it and widens his eyes for the orb. Soon he is verified. I wasn't told anything about the privacy policy, he says on his way out. I just came for the money. I thought of an encounter I witnessed in Seoul. In the room above the restaurant, Cho Jong-yeon, 75, watched her friend get verified by an orb. Cho had been invited to do the same, but demurred. The reward was not enough for her to surrender part of her identity. Your iris is uniquely yours, and we don't really know how it might be used, she says. Seeing the machine made me think, are we becoming machines instead of humans now? Everything is changing, and we do not know how it'll all turn out. This article was abridged from the technology section, written by Billy Perigo, San Francisco and Seoul, with reporting by Stephen Kim, Seoul. Here's the page with 11 questions this time. Belinda Luscombe writes, Mike Birbiglia, B-I-R-B-I-G-L-I-A, the comedian on his fourth Netflix special, The Good Life, The Rise of Right-Wing Comics and Being Funny versus Being Famous. This is the question-answer format. Question, would you like to be famous? Answer, no, not at all. I said to my wife recently, it's a week away from when I'm famous for a month and then not for 2 years. Question, would you say you have made choices to not be famous? Answer, maybe, but I don't really know. People ask me to watch their solo shows. They're like, give notes. I saw one a few months ago, and I was like, what do you want it to be? The person was like, I want it to be bigger. And I'm like, well, that's not anything that I'm ever trying to do. Question, by bigger he means? Answer, more popular. My inflection point artistically in my career was 16 years ago when I had a CBS pilot not get picked up. After that, I thought, I only want to be rejected on my own terms. And then once I did my first one-person show, Sleepwalk With Me, it made me be comfortable having a niche. Question, what else helped you get to that place? Answer, part of it is having my daughter. The thing that's unspoken in the show is that opening up to everyone is a thing I want to teach my daughter. I think of my comedy as, am I being true to myself? And then, am I being true to my daughter? Question, is that more important to you than being funny? Answer, no. Being funny is the most important. That is ultimately what I have to offer. Sometimes John Mulaney will say to me, I feel like you should just do a full hour of straight jokes to remind people that you're as good as any just joke comedy. Excuse me, comic. And I'm like, yeah, but then I wouldn't be me. Question, it seems from the show like your childhood was stable, but a bit repressed. Is that right? Answer, what I'm realizing as I get older is that my childhood was much lonelier than I realized because I was this Mike Birbiglia comedian, but as a child, so no one got the jokes. Question, do you do therapy? Answer, I've done therapy since I had my first really hard breakup when I was 22. My ex was my best friend, so I would call her to talk to her about our breakup, and at one point she goes, you cannot call me anymore. You need to get a therapist. And I've been going to her therapist's wife ever since. Question, do you have a no-go zone for jokes? What are the rules around what you share about your family? Answer, my wife Jenny and I are both writers. We always say, when something bad happens, go write it down and then maybe share it in 10 years. This special is the first time when I'm telling a story that's in my present. Question, do you feel fear in the comedy community right now? Answer, the decontextualization of sound and video in the last decade has made anyone who speaks into a microphone have a certain new level of self-consciousness. What does this paragraph sound like? What does this sentence sound like? What does this word sound like? You start to isolate everything, and I am not free of that. Question, what do you think is behind the rise of hard right-wing comics? Answer, tribalism has gotten so regimented that if either side steps out of line of what their tribe is saying, they get scolded on the internet. That has radicalized some people. I do not have a lot of political jokes, but I have this one where I go, people call us liberals, coastal elites, just because we live on the coast and we are better than other people. But what they don't realize is that we live part of the year in Aspen. Question, what would you say people like about you? Answer, the people who are diehard fans are maybe aware that I'm on a journey and I'm showing full disclosure. I always think of it this way. You never want to be more famous as a comedian than you are funny. I think sometimes people get too famous, not enough funny. Here is the time off section. A full page photo here of a young looking man. Slightly ruddy complexion, tousled blondish brown hair, wearing a white jacket over a white shirt that I think says OMP on the collar. Looking askew from the camera, but it's a close-up. F1 makes a pit, P-I-T-T, stop by Sean Gregory. Big stars and fast cars combine in a summer bid to fill theaters and grow a global fan base. Formula One teams treat their trade secrets like matters of national security. In a motorsport where milliseconds separate champions from also-rans, hiding technical know-how from opponents is as key as a fresh pair of tires. So when Joseph Kosinski, director of F1 the movie, the summer blockbuster Hopeful, starring Brad Pitt, and hitting theaters and IMAX June 27, tried to gain access to the inner workings of Formula One, a rush of deja vu hit him. After all, Kosinski made Top Gun Maverick, the 2022 naval aviator smash that grossed $1.5 billion with the support of the U.S. Department of Defense. It was the same level of security, he says, that I experienced when I went to some secret bases. Kozinski spent a year bugging Toto Wolff, team principal of the Mercedes AMG Petronas F1 team, for permission to film at the Mercedes race simulator. Most Mercedes employees themselves cannot access this space at headquarters, 70 miles northwest of London. But Wolff finally relented. So in the movie, viewers will see Pitt and Damson Idris, who respectively play Sonny Hayes and Joshua Pierce, drivers for the fictional APXGP team, practicing on Mercedes high-priced toys. "We were keen on contributing to this success," says Wolff, who, along with F1 president and CEO Stefano Domenicali, is credited as an executive producer. "That means you cannot be half pregnant and say, yeah, we're playing along, but no, we don't want to let you into our factory." The F1 filmmaker still made post-production alterations to protect Mercedes' intellectual property. All sides had to compromise and deliver in unique ways to bring F1 to life. It was all part of a delicate balancing act between a big-budget production team led by Jerry Bruckheimer, used to calling its own shots, and a $3.4 billion sport with a dedicated global fan base, whose participants could not afford distractions just to appear in some Hollywood fantasy. Sure, F1 was allowed to bring its cast and crew to actual races across the globe, but they would have to film during downtime on the track or just blend into the background. "The live sport," says Domenicali, "I cannot touch." The stakes were similarly high in a movie industry where original stories struggle to compete with familiar IP. Box office successes would be meaningful for future original ideas. And the involvement of Apple, whose studio arm backed the film, which will live on Apple TV Plus after F1's Warner Brothers Pictures distributed theatrical run, added another element of complexity. It was very, very complicated trying to have Apple and F1, two massive organizations that are very controlling of their own brands, to play along, says Kosinski. But the fact that Stefano had the vision for the film and Apple took the gamble on the movie, here we are 4 years later. We are about to take it out to the world. F1's origin story begins a decade ago when Kozinski was developing a script called Go Like Hell, which later became the 2019 Oscar-winning auto racing hit Ford v. Ferrari. Kozinski had Tom Cruise and Pitt attached to the roles that would eventually be played by Matt Damon and Christian Bale. Cruise and Pitt even did a script read at Cruise's house. But Kozinski dropped out, mainly over budget conflicts, and turned his attention to Top Gun with Cruise and Bruckheimer. During the pandemic, Kozinski caught the racing bug again while binging Formula One Drive to Survive, Netflix's series chronicling Formula One's behind-the-scenes intrigue. Kozinski emailed seven-time F1 champion Lewis Hamilton, a cinephile who planned to join the Top Gun cast, before realizing he could not swing that and chase championships. Kozinski told him he needed his help making the most authentic auto racing movie ever. Kozinski got Hamilton, a producer on the film who makes a cameo, Bruckheimer, and Pitt on board. The goal was to gain access to F1 races and factories so they would not have to CGI the whole thing. In early 2022, Kozinski, Bruckheimer, and Pitt met with Domenicali in London. Domenicali accompanied Kozinski and Pitt at a private Top Gun screening to give the F1 boss a taste of the whiz-bang effects such a film could bring to his sport. He saw the potential A movie fronted by Pitt could corral a mass audience and leave them wanting to know more about F1. This has always been the strategy, says Domenicali, to connect with new people, new markets. Still, some F1 race teams remain skeptical. They were nervous about being portrayed in an unflattering light. Somebody's got to be the villain, says Bruckheimer. And while there is a minor character unassociated with any actual F1 race team who emerges as a foil to Hayes, Bruckheimer made clear the story centers on the tension between two drivers, the aging Hayes and the up-and-comer Pierce on the same fictional team. That is a familiar dynamic. Both drivers are seeking individual success and want to beat the pants off the other guy. At least nominally, however, they are supposed to play nice on the track. At Mercedes, for example, Hamilton and Nico Rosberg, the 2016 F1 champion, famously clashed. It became real hostile, recalls Wolf. Mercedes helped convert cars from Formula 2, the minor league circuit, into machines that could pass for F1 cars. The filmmakers had a half dozen at their disposal. If they wanted to film a scene in which Pitt's APXGP car passes a Ferrari, they would stage that action with their own cars at an F1 track between practice and qualifying sessions before a race. Later, they would skin the Ferrari design over the production car to make it look like a Ferrari on the screen. Kosinski used this skinning technique with the Top Gun jets. They could also capture actual race footage and skin the APXGP car over the Red Bulls and Ferraris. The production team installed 15 camera mounts on its cars, filming with up to four at once to capture Pitt and Idris in their cockpits and action on the track. Brad Pitt, he's driving the car, says Eddie Q, Apple's senior vice president of services. It is not blue screen or CGI. Both actors learned to drive as fast as 180 miles per hour, not too far off from real F1 drivers' top speeds of around 220 miles per hour. These guys were fast, says Javier Bardem, who plays Ruben Cervantes. The owner of the struggling APXGP team who recruits Pitts Hayes at a Florida coin laundry in a Hail Mary attempt to lift his squad. The first time I saw them racing, I said to Joe, "What's insurance got to say about that?" Joe goes, "What insurance?" F1 filmed at 14 races during the 2023 and 2024 F1 seasons across three continents. The production reportedly cost more than $200 million. During some races, APXGP had their own garage, paddock, and perch along the pit wall, where the fictional team principal, technical director, and race engineers sit. "We designed it ourselves," says Bruckheimer. One of the Mercedes designers came in there and said, "SH/T, I'm going to lose my job." Much like the actual Formula One drivers, the actors needed to be on their games, even the ones who never sat in the driver's seat. Right before the start of the 2023 British Grand Prix, F1 shot a scene in which Cervantes introduces Hayes to a team board member, played by Tobias Menzies. It was like performing a live stage play in front of more than 150,000 spectators. Formula One was not about to hold up the race for repeated takes. "It was terrifying," says Bardem. "I kept telling myself, don't F-space-CK it up, Javier. Don't F-space-CK it up." He did not. Okay, I had to stop for a second and laugh there. All right. proceeding to the end now. The production crescendoed in Abu Dhabi last December when, after the actual podium celebration recognizing Lando Norris's victory, Charles Leclerc of Ferrari, Mercedes' George Russell, and one of the APX GP drivers mounted the podium to celebrate the fake F1 finish. Wolf filmed his cameo in Abu Dhabi. He tells Idris's Pierce to call him if he wants to jump ship to Mercedes. Wolf was not impressed with his own work. I do not think I'm going to follow Arnold Schwarzenegger as the next big Austrian thing, he says, with his pronounced accent. While the film puts a premium on authenticity to please the car heads, it also strives to attract general moviegoers with its soaring Hans Zimmer score. High-speed crashes, Hayes-Pierce conflict, romance between Hayes and the team's technical director, Kate McKenna, Oscar nominee Kerry Condon. The sensitivities surrounding a workplace relationship between F1's fictional first female team tech director and one of her drivers, which would seem quite scandalous if it went public in real life, did cross Kosinski's mind. But when he floated it to F1 insiders, no one objected. Romances within the tight-knit world are relatively common. I am not worried, says Domenicali, and by the way, it gives you the right Hollywood touch. The producers insist feedback has been positive. According to Domenicali and Q, when test audiences unfamiliar with F1 are asked, after watching, if anyone would now be interested in attending a race, hands go up. Stakeholders also hope it gives diverse audiences the itch to work in the industry. It's going to inspire female engineers and mechanics, says Hamilton. It's going to inspire people from all over, from all different backgrounds. Sounds like lofty expectations for popcorn fare, but the F1 portrayed on the big screen, globetrotting from Italy to Japan, to Vegas, to the Middle East, with its fireworks on and off the track, undoubtedly has its upsides. Aerodynamics lesson, anyone? Still in time off, here is a review from television. A good, G-O-O-D-E, detective with a rotten attitude by Judy Berman. Department Q, a Netflix crime drama from The Queen's Gambit writer-director Scott Frank, presents itself as a show about difficult people. Its anti-hero, Edinburgh police detective Carl Mork, M-O-R-C-K, has just come back to work after being shot in the line of duty, while berating a young cop who was killed before Carl could finish his rant. Body cam footage of the shooting, along with an already irascible reputation, ensures his return is anything but triumphant. The premiere also introduces Merritt Lingard, a prickly prosecutor whose hostile cross-examination of a man she is sure murdered his wife infuriates her colleagues. There's great potential in the entwining of these good guys with bad personalities whose obsessive pursuit of justice has left them isolated and embittered. If only the show's many plot twists did not restrain its parallel accounts by limiting viewers' perspective on Merritt, Chloe Peary. Frank, adapting a series of novels by Danish author Jussi Adler Olsen, is ultimately more invested in Carl. That, in some ways, disappointing choice does set up a detective series with the potential to run for many seasons without getting old, thanks to characters and performances richer than we normally see in this overcrowded genre. As portrayed by the charming Matthew Good, The Crown, Downton Abbey, Carl, an Englishman who complains incessantly about his adoptive home of Scotland, is as fascinating in his self-protective arrogance as he is frustrating. The phrase superiority complex seems to be the overall theme of your personnel file, notes Dr. Irving, awry Kelly MacDonald, the therapist he's been ordered to see. He replies he's less impressed with himself than he is unimpressed by other people. This attitude is his way of suppressing his guilt over not just his inferior's death, but also the grave injury suffered by his still hospitalized partner, DCI James Hardy, Jamie Sevis, in an incident for which everyone seems to blame Carl. A more formulaic detective show would send him on a rogue mission to apprehend the assailant who shot all three cops. Yet Frank, who wrote or co-wrote all 9 episodes and directed 6, makes the intriguing decision to keep that case mostly in the background. The season focuses instead on Carl's new assignment to establish Department Q, a cold case division funded by leaders bent on generating positive press by creating fodder for crime podcasts. This is hardly an honor. Carl's boss, Moira Kate Dickey, a woman with a perma-grimace who despises him, resents being forced to reopen old cases when she urgently needs resources for active ones, so she gives Carl a box of yellowing files, banishes him to a murky sub-basement, and uses his budget to buy everyone else new computers. Though Moira is none too eager to give him the help he needs, Hardy has nothing better to do while convalescing than scrutinize evidence, and Department Q eventually cobbles together a small staff. A nerve-shattering accident has confined Detective Constable Rose Dixon, Leah Byrne, to her desk. Unpleasant as it can be, working with Carl gives the young officer a chance to get back in the field, where she flexes the warmth and people skills he lacks. Recruited from IT, Syrian refugee Akram Salim, Alexei Manvalov, who claims to have relevant experience from his home country, has been bugging Moira to put him on the force. Like Carl, Akram crosses lines, though his transgressions are fueled by expediency rather than temper. Back home, were you working for the good guys or the bad guys? Carl asks him. When you know which is which, he replies, please do tell me. This sense of moral confusion around how we should feel about detectives who do bad things in service of good outcomes, whether the blame for their behavior lies with institutions that rarely work well without manipulation, pervades the series. No easy answers are provided as the missing person case Department Q takes on complexifies. This is in large part a refreshing break from the didactic tone of so many crime shows, though Frank does leave some compelling ideas insufficiently examined. He seems more concerned with introducing relationships and storylines that could fuel subsequent seasons by developing characters in tandem with the central mystery. His coyness about major aspects of Carl's personal life does feel a bit gratuitous, though they're very different. Carl, Rose, Akram, Hardy, and even Moira have all been scarred by jobs that force them to absorb endless trauma. I am two people, Carl reflects, in a rare moment of vulnerability, one who's immersed in humanity's ugliest impulses and another who's struggling to project normality. It is an effective choice to lean into the protagonist's cognitive dissonance instead of trying too hard to maintain a uniform mood. By inhabiting the interiority of detectives who live in our mundane world but have to keep their heads in a scarier one, Department Q expands beyond typical crime fare in much the same way the Queen's Gambit transcended chess. The first season lacks the latter show's depth, but what it accomplishes should be enough to make it very popular. In that case, it could become one of TV's best procedurals, with as many opportunities to go deeper as there are files on Carl's desk. Also by Judy Berman, Television Redemption on the Back Nine. This may be a bridge, we'll see. The third episode of the new Apple TV Plus golf comedy, Stick, is called Daddy Issues, but Daddy Issues might as well be the title of the show. Created by Ford v. Ferrari screenwriter Jason Keller, it stars Owen Wilson as a former top golfer, Price Cahill, who was cast out of the sport after an extremely public flame-out two decades ago. He has been mired in the past ever since, from his job outfitting hobbyists at a sporting goods store to his refusal to finalize his divorce after years of separation from his long-suffering wife, Judy Greer, move out of their old house, and accept he's no longer a husband or a father or a pro athlete. When he spots a surly teen at the local driving range, Santiago Wheeler, Peter Dager, or Dager, who has the makings of a generational superstar, Price sees in this potential protege a shot at redemption. But Santi, who's now a strange dad, used to push him too hard on the golf course, does not exactly relish the prospect of having a new father figure to satisfy. It sounds hackneyed and heartstring yanking, another comedy that uses sports as a cover for an earnest exploration of men's feelings and relationships from the platform that brought us Ted Lasso. There are indeed elements of Stick that come off as pandering to fans of Lasso's fictional team, AFC Richmond, as if a dad rock soundtrack, Baba O'Reilly, The Boys Are Back in Town, were not enough. It even rips off Lasso's world-weary folk theme song. While it is a relief that Greer's Amber Lynn is not made out to be a harpy, the show can be cringingly conspicuous in its efforts to model empathy for women. A self-described, genderqueer, anti-capitalist, post-colonial feminist character named Zero, Lily Kay, initially reads as an assemblage of lazy Gen Z cliches that exist mostly in the overactive imaginations of boomers. Yet within the limitations of its formula, Stick works. A trite setup gives way to a looser road trip vibe after Price persuades Santi and his savvy mom, Elena, Mariana Trevino, to pile into an RV with him and his cranky ex-caddy, Mitz, and effectively typecast Mark Maron, for a summer of amateur tournaments. Everyone here is low-key lonely, with familial baggage that keeps them from connecting with others. Thankfully, Keller's scripts aren't as twee or didactic about this stuff as Lasso and Shrinking creator Bill Lawrence's tend to be, nor are his characters larger-than-life cartoons like Ted. Most, including Zero, quickly become multifaceted people, courtesy of a cast blessed with unshowing charisma. A game-changer it is not, but Stick still comes out a few strokes ahead. Well, turning the page now for an abridged version of Time Off Reviews Movies, Approaching the End with Deliberate Steps, by Stephanie Zakarik. Stories about the meaning of life tend to work at cross purposes with the job of actually living it, particularly when they pedal hard to activate the tear ducts. Mike Flanagan's science fiction Life Affirmer, The Life of Chuck, adapted from a Stephen King novella, is an ambitious little film that has already earned some laurels. It was an audience favorite at last year's Toronto International Film Festival, winning the People's Choice Award. Thanks to a few key moments and the strength of its actors, it is easy to see why audiences would warm to the film. But if you're immune to its charms, you will not be alone. From its cute fake soundstage town setting, to the authoritative yet chummy voiceover narration, courtesy of Nick Offerman, the life of Chuck works doggedly to give you the warm fuzzies, and a little bit of that fuzz goes a long way. The story is ingeniously or pretentiously, depending on your mood, constructed to unspool backward, beginning with the third act and ending with the first. In the opening section, Chiwetel Ejiofor plays schoolteacher Marty, whose class is interrupted just as his students are digging into Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, particularly its key phrase, "I contain multitudes." A student gasps. She's just seen the news on her phone. Part of California has fallen into the ocean. Then the internet shuts down altogether, possibly for good. The end times are near, maybe, and the world's getting ready. Marty sees a weird billboard featuring a smiling man in a business suit and the words, "Charles Krantz, 39 great years," and says, "Thanks, Chuck." The missing comma in that last phrase is presumably just one of the mysteries of life. Marty does not know who Chuck is, nor does anyone he asks, but this billboard, followed by other mysterious Chuck references, may hold the key to the end of the world. That was Abridged. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.